All right. So I'm given the opportunity to introduce a number of really quite amazing people today and tomorrow, and John is certainly one of them. Somebody who I've known for 10 years, John, plus or minus. I think we've sort of came up in the same class, as it were, at Acres with the community that we're, a lot of the principles of biological systems have been developed and shared for probably 40 years now, at least. We have gone separate paths. John is traveling the for-profit consultant agronomist path, and I've been working on the nonprofit educational organization path, but I feel like it's been very, very parallel. I've learned immense amounts from him over the years. Certainly a lot of what people who have heard me speak about, I've actually gleaned out of John's head. So I'd like to offer a lot of thank you. Thank you, John. So we talked about all the critical points of influence in the plant's life cycle and what are the places where we can get the best bang for your buck, where are the places where we lose the most yield, the most capacity, the most potential, and seed is one of those topics that I think is never appreciated as much as it needs to be in relation to this. So I'm really happy to have John talking about how we can improve seed quality and sort of engage that aspect. So I'll read his introduction here and then get out of the way and let him speak. John is the founder of Advancing Eco-Agriculture, a leading crop health consultant and designer of innovative soil and plant management systems. Growing fresh market vegetables since 1994, John witnessed intensifying disease and insect pressure on crops, which gradually failed to respond to the usual pesticide treatments. His mission is to provide support to the world's farmers and globally impact our food supply. He founded Advancing Eco-Agriculture in 2006, which has quickly become a leader in the area of soil and plant nutrition. A little bit of phlegm. John is an internationally recognized speaker on the topic of biological agriculture and plant immunity. He has a unique ability to simplify and clearly explain very complex concepts in the areas of soil and plant health. He skillfully discusses the larger social and environmental impacts of food, agriculture, and ecology. Through intense study, the knowledge gleaned from many industry leaders, he began building a comprehensive systems-based approach to plant nutrition, a system solidly based on the sciences of plant physiology, mineral nutrition, and soil microbiology. All right, John, you're on.
Thank you, Dan. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I am I'm honored to be here today. Thank you, Dan, for inviting me, and thank you for that introduction. Many, many, many interesting things have happened in the journey since Dan and I first met a decade ago. And the pathway that I have gone down, as Dan described it, is after founding Advancing Eco-Agriculture, we started, our primary emphasis and what we really became known for was helping farmers grow crops that were very resistant to disease and insect pests by balancing nutrition and by balancing that nutrition to really enhance their immune system. So today, and what I personally am really passionate about and what took me down that pathway was based on some experiences that we had on our own farm where we started losing crops. We had a three-year period, 2000, 2003, and 4, in which we lost a substantial amount of the crops that we were growing on the home family vegetable farm that I grew up on, and pesticides were completely ineffective. So from those experiences, we started working with plant nutrition to try to increase a plant's immune system, to increase resistance and so forth. And on this pathway, I discovered that, first of all, I discovered that it is possible to grow and produce crops that are completely resistant to diseases and insects, which is a really, really big claim to make. I'm not talking about partial resistance. I'm talking about complete resistance, 100% resistance. And I'll be talking tomorrow afternoon about some of the science behind that and how to accomplish that. But then, as we started working with farms and as soil health and plant health began to evolve, then two other things happened as well, which were incredibly powerful and gave me tremendous inspiration. The first was that when we began developing plants that had such an exceptional level of immunity, such extraordinary immunity, not only were they capable of being resistant to diseases and insects, but they had the capacity to transfer that immunity to the people who consumed that food. When you have plants that produce extremely high concentrations of secondary plant metabolites, those secondary plant metabolites are actually also very strong immune enhancers for our own immune systems as well. So then the second piece was when we began working with farms in extremely degraded environments, extremely degraded soil conditions, and we realized that we have missed one of our biggest opportunities to build soil health. Particularly within the domain of organic agriculture, biological agriculture, the common paradigm is that it takes extremely healthy soil, it takes healthy soil to grow healthy plants. And we discovered that there is another side to that coin, that the fastest way to regenerate and rebuild soil health is to grow extraordinarily healthy plants. Because when you grow really healthy plants and really healthy crops, they rebuild soil faster than anything else that you can do. And I can tell you right now that on commercial farming systems, on a commercial scale, anything over a couple of acres, you cannot economically justify, you cannot economically afford to put on enough compost, to put on enough soil amendments to match what a really healthy crop can do. So it is actually possible to grow plants, to grow crops that provide food for people and to regenerate soil at the same time when plants cross a certain threshold of health. And that, to me, was incredibly empowering and inspiring because that now gave us the means with which to not just grow a tremendous amount of food, but also to regenerate soil health at the same time and to sequester extraordinary amounts of carbon. This is not the purpose of the discussion today, but I think it is worth commenting on that. On some of the farms that we have worked with, we have seen soil organic matter increases by 1% per year on dry land farming while growing a corn crop every year. That is extraordinary. And all of the crops that we grow today have the potential to accomplish those kinds of results. So from the work that we were doing in fruit and vegetable production and broadacre crops, as a company where we are today, we have become known for three things. Today we're working on several thousand farms, mostly here in North America, but increasingly internationally as well, South America, Africa, and Europe. And we have really become known in the fruit and commercial fruit and vegetable production space for three things. One is for increasing disease and insect resistance, which is kind of the original intent that we began with. Second is for producing extraordinary fruit quality and firmness, shelf life, flavor, any parameter that you can think of that impacts fruit quality. We have been very fortunate to learn a lot about how to manage fruit quality with nutrition. And then the third piece, and something that I personally believe is very important, is we have become known for helping farmers make more money and be more profitable using regenerative farming systems than conventional farming systems. I personally am really passionate about the work that we are doing. My personal mission, my personal goal is I want these regenerative models of agriculture to become the status quo around the world against which everything else is measured. And in order for us to do that, in order for us to achieve that goal, we have to be able to demonstrate to farmers that they can make more money using regenerative farming systems than conventional farming systems. And the moment that happens, the dialogue is over. The argument is over. And we have begun seeing this now in our work where very commercial, very mainstream, extremely large-scale fruit and vegetable growers, some of the largest in the country, are wanting to shift and switch and discontinue pesticide use. And that is something that I am really inspired by. Along this pathway, I made a very interesting observation and something that Dan and I have talked about over many times over the last decade is the substantial impact that genetics have on nutrition and on nutritional integrity, and also how nutrition in the field impacts seed production and fruit quality production. So Dan invited me here this afternoon to talk about seed quality. And through this discussion this afternoon, I'll be talking about many different aspects of plant physiology and plant development in a very broad, high-level context. And you might think that it doesn't directly connect to seeds, but it will come around full circle to where we will see how everything that happens in a plant's life impacts seed quality. When we look at fruit and vegetable production, which is the context that I will largely be speaking from because it's one that I'm most familiar with, for many fruit and vegetable crops, the reproductive parts of the plant are the weakest parts of the plant. They are physiologically the weakest. You think about a cucurbit crop such as cantaloupe or zucchini or winter squash or cucumbers or something like that. Where do the cucumber beetles go first? The blossoms and the flowers. If you think about apples and apple production, where are the first and the most severe insect attacks? On the flowers. And this isn't universally true for all crops, but it is true for the majority of crops, that the reproductive parts of the plant, from a health perspective, are often the weakest part of the plant. And the reason for that is because those reproductive parts of the plant require the highest mineral concentrations and the highest nutrient concentrations of any other part of the plant. The concentrations of zinc and manganese and copper and boron, all these trace minerals in the reproductive parts of the plant are often 10, 15, 20 times higher than the surrounding tissue, sometimes as much as 60 to 80 times higher. And they need to be because all of the embryo formation, pollen formation, all of these different parts of the reproductive system require extremely high trace mineral concentrations. So what I want to talk about today is how this happens, why it happens from a plant physiology perspective, and how we can prevent it from happening. So when we talk about genetics, I really like to begin with this quote from Luther Burbank, where he says that heredity is nothing more than stored environment. Today, within genetics, there is, completely excluding the conversation about GMOs, which is a conversation and dialogue all in and of itself, there is constant effort to breed crops for higher flavor, for better shelf life, for greater yields, for specific disease resistance, for all of these various characteristics that we're looking for. And those breeding efforts certainly have some value, but they are incomplete in and of themselves. When we focus purely on the genetics piece, that means we are completely missing the environmental piece. And we can see this very clearly when Francis and Crick first identified and postulated the structure of DNA. We believed that we would be able to, with our understanding of DNA and genetics, that we would be able to produce genetic treatments and reverse and halt all degenerative illness of stroke, diabetes, heart disease, etc. We believed that genetics held a solution for all of those problems. But as we learned more about genetics and realized that we didn't really know what we thought we knew, from that emerged the science of epigenetics. And the basic premise of epigenetics is simply that environment determines genetic expression. And as farmers, as growers, all of you know this really well. You can have seed, high-quality seed, or medium-quality seed, and plant it into two different soil types in two different environments and produce two completely different responses and produce two completely different plants. So think about what happens then when you grow those two completely different plants and now you save seeds and plant seeds that were grown in a certain environment into a different environment yet again. You can very rapidly accelerate or very rapidly degenerate the integrity of a specific genetic line. So genetic potential, Genetic potential is carried inside the seed, but that is only potential. It's still in its raw form. Genetic expression and the way those genes express themselves in the environment is determined completely by the environment. So this is why on some vegetable crops you can have a variety that is, let's say you have a variety of pumpkins that is powdery mildew resistant. It is powdery mildew resistant, and yet when you plant it into some environments, it is still going to have powdery mildew because it's not a genetics problem. It's an environmental problem. And when we talk about plant production in terms of the environment, environment-determined genetic expression, we have to ask the question, okay, what is the environment in the context of a plant? There is obviously air, sunlight, water, sunshine, and so forth. The major pieces that mediate a plant's responses and buffer a plant's responses to climate extremes and to the rest of the environment is the mineral nutrition, the mineral integrity of that crop. So, epigenetics, environment determines genetic expression. When talking with plant breeders and geneticists, corn is one of the crops that is extremely well understood. One of the reasons why I'm using it as an example, I'm going to use it as one of the main examples in this discussion because of the amount of research that has been done on it. Corn geneticists will tell us that 100% all the corn varieties available in the marketplace today have the inherent genetic capacity to produce 1,100 bushels per acre. And you go, wait, what? We're consistently, the United States average for all U.S. production right now is, I think, 157 bushels per acre, about 18% of that number. If you look at cherries, the genetic potential is for 20,000 pounds per acre. Actually, I think it's even greater than that. Tomatoes, 180,000 pounds per acre. We are actually now working with greenhouse tomato growers who are pushing this number. 90 tons of tomatoes per acre. It's tremendous, tremendous potential. Field scale production, we consistently only harvest a very small fraction of that. If we look at sweet corn production, in some environments, the exact same seed, the exact same variety, when we plant it onto bare ground, a bare ground environment will produce 800 dozen per acre. If you plant that exact same variety into plastic culture with drip irrigation, you can have it built, planted on the exact same soil, same environment, everything is identical, but with plastic mulch and drip irrigations, you have consistent watering, will double the yield per acre. Exact same plant population, because it increases the number of ears per plant. So, the way this happens is that we have this gradual yield loss throughout the entire growing season. So, for example, the moment a corn seed is planted, if that corn seed has the genetic capacity to produce 1,100 bushels per acre, let's say it's planted into cold, wet soil, and now it drops down to 800 bushels per acre because of the stress that that seedling incurred. Perhaps the seed was planted too deep and had to struggle to emerge, and now you reduce the number down to 750 bushels per acre. Perhaps nutrients were not placed correctly to allow that plant to really take off and grow, and now you reduce it down to 650 bushels per acre. Whatever it is, I'm making up the numbers. The numbers are not even relevant. The point is that what happens throughout the growing season, every single time that stress is placed on a seed or on a plant, that plant's future harvest potential is dropping and is being reduced, and further reduced, and further reduced, to the point at which you finally harvest the crop, you're harvesting only a fraction of what you originally started with. So what this means is that when we get a yield response from something that we do, putting on a foliar application of nutrients, cultivation, pruning, whatever the case might be, when we get a yield response from something that we've done in the field, the reality is that we have not increased yields. We've simply kept those yields from being lost. Simply kept those yields from being lost because the plant had the seed, had that original raw potential in it the day that it was planted. And so for us as growers, as farmers, we need to, the framework for thinking of yield and quality increases is all about answering the question, how do you reduce stress or how do you buffer stress? Because when you can buffer out that stress or reduce stress, You allow that plant to keep more of its inherent genetic potential all the way through the season. So, as we look at plant development, plant growth through the season, we see this expansion-contraction cycle that happens all the time. And this is actually the first time that I'm presenting this information quite in this way. And it's very, very important. It's something that we take into consideration all the time when making our recommendations on the farms that we work on. So in all plant growth, you have this constant expansion-contraction cycle. Male energy, female energy. First, both are always present. There's always both male and female energy present inside a plant. But they alternate in terms of which is dominant. First, male energy is dominant, then female energy is dominant, then male, back and forth. And so it's, you can imagine a fulcrum or a seesaw where it's constantly moving back and forth from one to the next throughout the entire growing season. So all plants have these cycles. And they usually have many more than what we might think of. So this development, these various cycles, these expansion-contraction cycles of male and female energy are the foundation for a concept that we call critical points of influence. And so critical points of influence, and I'll describe this in more detail in a bit, but there are two types of critical points of influence. The first type is right at the peak moment of each cycle, and the second type is the transmission, the shift from the vegetative cycle to the reproductive cycle. And I want to describe what these look like. So, how many cycles do you think a corn plant would have? How many shifts from vegetative to reproductive, back and forth, if you had to guess? Any guesses? Only the people who don't already know the answer and haven't already heard this presentation before are allowed to guess.
I'm afraid to guess.
You're afraid to guess one? Yeah. So, I was a guess of four. Anyone else? So usually, kind of first initial reaction is to say, well, a corn plant is vegetative until it starts silking and tasseling, and then it goes reproductive for the rest of the season. That's kind of an initial reaction. But in reality, there is a lot more happening than that. Actually, a corn plant will have 13 cycles, 13 transitions from one to the next to the next. So I don't know how detailed this is. I'm going to go through this in more detail in a little bit, but I did not detail all the vegetative stages, but I put out all the reproductive stages. So first you have ear embryo determination, when the number of ear is being determined. Then you have when the number of rows in that ear is being determined. Two cycles later, then you have several weeks later, you have the number of kernels in each row being determined. And then you have the tassel and the blossom being developed. Then you have ear silking and pollination. Then you have endosperm development when the embryo within that seed is actually maturing and filling. And so, and that's just the reproductive side. That is, those are all sandwiched by vegetative parts of the reproduction cycle. So, if we look at trees as a simpler example, these are all the spur-bearing trees. And there is actually more detail in this. I simplified this down just to make it easier. So most of these spur-bearing trees will have six cycles, six major macro cycles. There's a few other smaller cycles in here as well. But it begins in the spring with blossoming and pollination. So many trees will, first thing in the spring, they bloom and pollinate. So you have this very strong reproductive flush. As soon as we have blossom and pollination complete, then they initiate initial shoot development. That now it switches to vegetative growth. So first you have reproductive growth, now it switches to vegetative growth. And then, which is male energy, then it switches back to reproductive female energy by when it begins setting the buds and bud initiation for next year's crop. After that, it switches back to... Yeah.
How do you know that it's switching? How do you know it's not just both at the same time? How do you know...
They are both present at the same time. The dominance is switching when one is dominant to the other is dominant.
How are you measuring that?
You can measure cytokine and auxin balances. You can measure hormone balances. You can visually observe how the plant is expressing itself as well. For example, if you observe root system flushes, if you observe reproductive system flushes, you can see it happening. So, from bud initiation, we switch to fruit fill, and when you think about it, from initially, you might expect fruit fill to be reproductive, but actually fruit fill is vegetative because it is expansion energy, and you're really filling that fruit. And then it switches to senescence, when that tree begins senescing in the fall and dropping leaves, which is, again, contraction energy, where all the energy is being withdrawn from the leaves back into the tree. And then that energy that is withdrawn into the tree is now put out again to build and to fill spur buds for next year's spring leaf development. So we have this cycle happening with these trees. Now, the interesting part is what happens at different stages of this transition, and this is something that... It's a little bit hard for me to describe what this looks like in the field, but I can absolutely describe the effects of what happens when we understand this in the field. So the first piece is that when we have a lack of nutritional integrity or environmental stress, climactic stress, at the peak moment of each cycle, it sabotages yield potential. So what I was describing earlier, when we see yields drop throughout the entire growing season, that yield drop happens when there is inadequate nutrition to support embryo development, to support the reproductive functions, particularly at the top of the reproductive cycle. When we have nutrient imbalances at the top of the reproductive cycle, it has a much bigger impact than when we have nutritional imbalances at the top of the vegetative cycle. So, this is at the foundation of why we have blossom abortion on peppers, why we have poor pollination on cucurbit crops, almost any reproductive challenges. When you have reproductive challenges, so if you have a cucumber plant, or let's take a cantaloupe plant, for example. A cantaloupe plant, most cantaloupe genetics today, will produce in the neighborhood of 8 to 10 female blossoms. Some varieties, under really good management, will produce as much as 20 to 25 female blossoms on every plant. So that is the genetic potential that that seed contained within it, that those genetics contain. So that plant is telling us it has the inherent genetic potential to produce 8 to 10 melons per plant. But when that plant doesn't have the right nutrition and enough nutrition to support those reproductive parts of the plant, either so that we either have poor pollination or we have blossoms that abort before they ever open and pollinate and have the chance to pollinate, or when we have abortion after pollination. All of those things are a result of nutritional deficiencies happening at these specific stages. So when we work with farms, to one of the things that we have become known for is really helping to consolidate fruit set. So on blueberries, for example, it's very common for us to see an entire blueberry harvest all blossom and pollinate within about a 2 to 3 week window. So we have a very concentrated set and very concentrated harvest period. And for some varieties, that and for some producers, if they want an extended harvest window, that can actually be a challenge. But that's one of the things that happens as plants become very healthy and very vigorous, you tend to get a much more concentrated fruit set. But now the other interesting piece is when you have a lack of nutritional integrity at the transition from vegetative to the reproductive, it actually triggers proteolysis inside that plant and it creates disease and insect susceptibility. So this is very important. This only happens in the transition from vegetative to reproductive. It doesn't happen the other way around. It does not happen when you have the transition from reproductive to vegetative. And again, this ties back to nutritional integrity. The reason this happens is because when those plants have enough nutrients to support that switch, they will begin sabotaging themselves. So let's go back to the tree fruit example. If you have a tree fruit such as a cherry tree or an apple tree or a pear tree, and they begin blossoming and blooming in the spring, you have blossoming and pollination, and then a week, at the end of pollination, you get leaf emergence concurrently with pollination. That window is the window of greatest disease and insect susceptibility by a factor of 10x easily. Those trees are more susceptible to diseases and insects in that initial 5-week window after they begin pushing buds than they are at any other time of the year. And the reason for that is, and these trees, this is true to a very pronounced degree, even more so than many annual vegetable crops, because they have an extremely concentrated and consolidated fruit set. When you have all these blossoms pollinating on a tree, it's the equivalent of a pregnancy. It's the equivalent of that tree becoming pregnant. And there is a tremendous hormonal shift that happens inside that tree in a matter of 3 to 4 days. That hormonal shift is extremely dependent on being supported by calcium and boron and other trace minerals. And if the nutrition is lacking to support that hormonal shift, that tree switches to proteolysis, which means protein breakdown, and it becomes extremely susceptible to diseases and extremely susceptible to insects. I want you to stop and think for just a moment. When do we have the greatest level of scab infestation? When do we have the greatest challenges with codling moth? When do we have the greatest challenges with plum curculio? We can go down the entire list of all the diseases that these trees struggle with. 90% of the disease severity happens in that first 5-week window, because that tree's pregnancy has not been supported with the right nutrition. So when that happens, if that pregnancy has not been supported with the right nutrition, now you can also contemplate the integrity of that seed, the seed within that fruit, and what is it missing to be able to fully express itself and transfer that genetic information on to the next generation. And this, I'm bouncing back and forth. I'm talking about a lot of different crops. The reality is this holds true for every single crop that you are growing that reproduces by seed, I should say. It holds true for every single crop that you are growing to grow the fruiting body and the fruit of, or the seed. If you're growing kale or salad greens, then none of what I'm talking about is relevant. But short of that, any reproductive crop, these same cycles apply. So, if we switch back and look at corn as an example, I want to give a bit more detail here. So, according to some research that was done at the University of Iowa in 1992, they determined that 9 to 12 days after corn seed germinates, it is determining the number of ear embryos. So we have embryo differentiation happening at what is called the V2 stage. That's the first reproductive stage inside the plant. Then 14 to 21 days after germination, so you have a 9 to 12 day window, and then it switches back to vegetative. When it switches after that window, 2 days later, 14 to 21 day period, it switches back to reproductive and reproductive dominance, and now it determines the number of rows. 42 to 49 days later, it determines the number of kernels per row. And so when you look at this entire spectrum, these first three windows of reproductive development in a corn plant, there's several really interesting pieces that emerge. The first is the narrowness of the window. So that first window is 3 days long. The second window is 7 days long. You have a fairly narrow window, and the point for developing plant integrity and seed integrity, reproductive integrity, is that any level of stress that happens in that 3-day window is going to have a negative impact on that plant's development and on seed development. So if you have a hailstorm, if you have cold, wet weather, whatever happens in that 3-day window is going to suppress that plant's future reproductive potential.
Some of those things we can moderate and buffer against, and then there are some of those elements that are outside of our control. The second interesting part is that the greatest level of yield potential is determined earliest in the plant's life. This is true for all of the, what we would term, single-fruiting crops. So crops that all blossom and pollinate in a very condensed time frame. So these would be all the grains, small grains, corn. These would be all the tree fruit, which I talked about. For the tree fruit and these grain crops, if you look at this, when you have, I mean, when you can have an impact on the number of ears, you can have a much greater impact on yield potential than if you simply impact the number of rows or the number of kernels per row. You can have a much bigger crop response. That happens earliest in the plant's life. That is a universal principle that we have found in all the crops that we have looked at that have this characteristic of blossoming and pollinating at the same time. Now, when you have crops, what we refer to as the multiple fruiting crops that blossom and pollinate over an extended period, such as tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, that can pollinate for an extended period of time, that principle does not hold true. So the key, if we want to reduce yield loss, we simply need to reduce stress at these critical points of influence or to buffer climactic stress. So I'd like to give you an example just to describe what this can look like. This is a farm that we started working with, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago. Time flies pretty quickly. Farm Bioenergetic Harmonics in Atlanta, Indiana. They are growing blue food grade, this is certified organic blue food grade corn that gets used to make blue corn chips. So we began working with them in 2011, and this was the very first year that we worked on the farm. And it was an extremely dry spring. From the 1st of May to the 16th of July, they had 0.6 inches of rain on this farm. So this farm is surrounded by commercial commodity corn, and the regional harvest average for the region on the fields that were actually harvested was 40 to 60 bushels per acre, and that only happened on fields that were planted into a very narrow planting window. Anything that was planted after that window that missed one of the rainfalls, which basically after the 1st of May. Anything planted after the 1st of May was never harvested at all. They just took it off the field as corn silage because it wasn't going to make a grain crop at all. So on June 20th, if I recall correctly. It's been a while since I looked at this story. This picture is a picture that was taken of that field on June 20th on the fifth day of 10 days of 100 plus degree temperatures. So it was extremely warm, extremely dry, and you can see that some of the leaves are beginning to curl a little bit. There is definitely some moisture stress happening on this crop. And if you look at this on the far upper right of the picture, you can see a slight different color green. And that is from the field directly across the road. And that's what this field looked like. So, at harvest time, just as a frame of reference, this particular blue variety, a variety of blue corn, is known to be generally a lower yielding variety. And farmers in the Midwest are consistently doing about 100 to 105 bushels per acre. This farm has had a really strong track record for, they were growing this farm this variety for the 4 years prior to when we started working with them. And they had a four-year best yield on the entire farm was 110 bushels per acre of this variety. So in 2012, I was wrong about the year, it was 2012, not 11. 2012, the very first year that we started working with them, they did 170 bushels per acre in the drought, when all the other surrounding farms had a complete crop disaster. And as if though that were not enough, the yield, first of all, the corn had an extremely dark blue-purple color, much more so than normal. Their historical average test weight over the prior 4 years was 56.5 pounds per bushel. And in 2012, that test weight jumped to 59.1 pounds per bushel. So this was extremely high quality seed and a substantial yield bump, 50% higher yields than anything that they had experienced before. This was the first instance in which we started trying to deeply understand what was happening that evolved into the concept, into the idea of critical points of influence. What happened on this corn crop? How was it possible that all the surrounding farmers had a crop disaster? On this farm, we increased the historical yield averages by a factor of 50%. How does that happen? What we did on this farm, this was the first year that we started working with them. This is a certified organic farm. They incorporated a cover crop of oats before the crop was planted, before the corn crop was planted. And we put together a nutritional solution that was applied in furrow at planting, and we followed up with three foliar sprays. We originally only intended to do two foliar applications, but we did one foliar application at the V4 stage, which is the stage when it's determining the number of rows per ear that it is going to have. We did a second foliar application at the V6 stage when it's determining the number of kernels. And then the third foliar spray that we had not planned on, had not intended on, was on day three of that 10-day window of 100 plus degree temperatures. So we put on the starter application and three foliar applications of nutrients. That was it. It's the only thing we did the entire growing season. And those four applications of nutrients were enough to give that plant a tremendous resilience against the moisture stress. So how did that happen? What was going on? I think there were several different pieces that were happening. The first, and so this is when I talk about the critical importance of nutrition, there is not just the direct impact of nutrition on a plant's reproductive balance and its hormonal balance. And actually, just to expand on that for a bit, when you give a plant really strong nutrition and its reproductive energy becomes supercharged, then you will see bud expression on some crops, not on all crops, but many crops, you will see bud expression that you have not observed before, that you might think is very abnormal. So take cucumbers, for example. We usually think that cucumbers are supposed to have one bud per node. We like to see commercial growers like to see one female bud, one female blossom at every node, at every leaf node. And we have photos of growers that we have worked with where they have two or three cucumbers on every node, all the way across the entire plant. And they're not just blossoms. They're maturing. They're filling these cucumbers. This is an incredible, incredible fruit load. Same for eggplants. Eggplants usually will have one blossom per node. We've seen that expand to have three to four blossoms per node. And there certainly are genetic characteristics here as well, because some genetics will do this much more easily than others. In peppers, for example, it is relatively easy to get chili peppers to get three to four blossoms per node and three to four fruit per node that we take all the way through to harvest. That doesn't happen as easily with bell peppers or hot peppers, for example. So there are genetic characteristics that come into play here as well. But in general, as a general rule, what we have observed is when you give plants really strong nutrition, the reproductive potential begins expressing itself to a new level, a new degree that we don't even consider as being normal, because we almost never get the opportunity to see it. Most of us here in this room have no idea what a really healthy plant actually looks like. We don't. And I consider that, we have tremendous opportunity, tremendous potential. All right, I got completely sidetracked from where I was going. Okay, so what happened with this corn crop? I think there were three main pieces that happened. That we didn't just have a direct impact on this plant's reproductive potential, but we had an indirect impact to buffer out and mediate climate stress that was actually much bigger than the direct impact that we had. So the indirect impact, I think, was threefold. The first is that when a plant has good nutrition, particularly when it has good potassium levels and good trace mineral levels, then it has the capacity to regulate the stomata, and it uses a lot less water, and it loses a lot less water from respiration. So I think these plants were much more water efficient right from the get-go. Secondly, if I go back to these pictures, there's a little bit of sunlight glare in this picture, but you can still see these plants have a glossy, waxy sheen. That glossy, waxy sheen on these leaves is a result of very strong lipid expression. These plants have extremely high fat concentrations. And these high levels of fats and oils inside the plant result in a waxy layer on the leaf surface. That is an indicator, one of the indicators that we use in the field to evaluate plants and to observe that plants have an extremely high energy level, because a plant has to have a surplus of energy to store high levels of fats, exactly the same way that we do. We don't store fats, animals don't store fats, unless they have a surplus of energy. Plants do the exact same thing. When they have a surplus of energy, they store the surplus in the form of fats and oils. So these plants had a surplus of energy. They had high oil concentrations and a high wax layer on the leaf, which again resulted in better water use efficiency. But the best part of all was the change in these plants' root systems. And the change in the root systems did not come about because of the fertilizers that were applied to the soil. They came about as a result of the fertilizers that were applied as a foliar. That had nothing to do with root system development directly. When you have extremely high test weight corn, there is only one possible way for that to happen. And the only way for that to happen is for that plant to have extremely high nutrient availability late in the growing season when it is filling that grain. It doesn't matter how good of a job you do of growing a great corn plant. It doesn't matter how good pollination you have. Nothing else matters. When you actually begin filling grain, you have to have extremely high levels of available nutrients to fill that grain at that period, or you will end up with low test weight grain. And we saw a substantial jump in test weight gains, and yet the soil was still really dry. We had had some rainfall by that point, but it was not generous by any measurement. So what happens is during this stage of corn development is what we refer to as the framing stage. And we describe the framing stage to describe what is happening with these plants in terms of carbohydrate transport and how they're moving sugars around. So just a very brief background is, oh boy, how are we doing on time? Don't see a clock. Okay. You mean I have 15 minutes left?
No, you've got 15 minutes to talk.
Okay, got it. Thank you. So, just to give you a frame of reference, many plants, a moment ago I made the comment that most of us in this room don't even know what a really healthy plant actually looks like. To give you a frame of reference for what I was talking about, every square inch of a leaf has a finite photosynthetic capacity that is based on the speed of all the biochemical pathways, the number of chlorophyll concentration, the number of cells, the number of chloroplasts, etc., etc. But there is a finite number, a finite limit to photosynthetic capacity. Let's call that number 100%. Most plants only photosynthesize in the neighborhood of 18 to 22% of their inherent photosynthetic capacity. Only less than 25%. Sometimes even much less than that. So think of what could happen if you could move that plant from 20% photosynthetic efficiency all the way up to 60%. You've just tripled the number of sugars, the amount of sugars produced in every 24-hour photo period. So all of a sudden, what we think of as normal, basic plant physiology, completely changes. So what happens is when we are successful in tripling the photosynthetic energy, the sugar production, we have in every 24-hour period, we have a 24-hour photo cycle. So what happens is that during the daylight, during sunlight hours, we have peak photosynthetic activity. And in that peak, we have sugar formation in the chloroplasts, in the cells, inside the leaf. Then, starting in late afternoon, those sugars begin to be transported out of the leaves, the photosynthetic factories, and moved to the sugar sinks. There are three basic sugar sinks inside plants. There is the new shoot growth at the top of the plant. There is the shoot growth at the bottom of the plant that we call roots, root development. And then you have the fruit. So these three sugar sinks are very different in terms of the way plants behave with them. If you look at, actually I'm going to be talking about this a bit in more detail tomorrow in one of my presentations, but if you look at a plant's total sugar production over the entire growing season, you have a total of 100%. That total of 100% over the course of that plant's entire life is going to be divided into four almost exactly equal pieces. 25% goes into fruit above the soil. 25% goes into vegetative biomass above the soil. Below the soil, 25% goes to root systems. 25% goes to root exudates. This only happens when plants cross the threshold of 60% or greater photosynthetic efficiency. If you don't have that level of photosynthetic efficiency, then that number changes. And the total volume changes, of course, and the division changes as well, where now you have a much higher proportion that goes into vegetative biomass and fruit, somewhere in the order of about 70%, and only 30% ends up below the soil surface. That's all that I can do for the background for the moment. If you want more detail on that, I'm going to be talking more about that tomorrow. But what happened in the case of this corn? So that sugar division of 25, 25, 25, 25 doesn't all happen equally at the same time. There is one stage that we call the framing stage, where the majority of the sugars produced in every 24-hour photo period go down to the root system and out through the root system as root exudates. So the framing stage, the stage when you have a corn plant that is 18 inches tall or a tomato plant that is 16 inches tall, and you think about it, for many of these annual crops, the framing stage happens about 6 to 8 weeks after being planted. Let's say you have a tomato plant that is 12 inches tall. It took that tomato plant 6 weeks to get this big. In the next 6 weeks, that plant is going to get this big. There is a tremendous amount of biomass growth that happens very, very quickly. And when you think about that, our first inclination is to think that, well, the majority of the sugar production is going into vegetative biomass at that point. But that's actually not the case. During that framing stage, every day, every 24-hour photo period, as much or even greater, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80% of the total sugar production every day goes down to the root system and out through the root systems as root exudates to feed soil biology. This is a well-researched number. It's reported in Horst Marschner's book, Mineral Nutrition, Higher Plants, and a number of other references. Horst Marschner's book, or now Petra Marschner has edited the last version, is used to teach plant physiology today in most major universities. So when I first read that number, 70% of the total sugars going out through the root system as root exudates, the first question that went through my mind is, why would a plant waste that much energy? And in reality, what is happening is that plant is not wasting its energy at all. It is building a reserve bank account that it can then tap into later in the growing season. So what happened is, we were able, with foliar applications, to keep this corn crop in 100-degree temperatures, to keep it still actively growing, and to keep it photosynthesizing. And it was actively photosynthesizing and transmitting sugars down into the root system. So that later, 10 weeks down the road, when we reached the grain fill stage, It was able to tap into those microbial metabolite reserves that it had accumulated in the root system and use that to produce extremely high test weight grain. This is the really fascinating part for me. Plants can access microbial metabolites and use them as a source of nutrition in the absence of free water in the soil profile. They are not dependent on water anymore. So this is how we can, in effect, completely drought-proof a crop. If the early establishment is critical, if we can get it off to a strong early establishment, build a strong microbial community in the root system and in the soil profile, you can actually develop a crop that has an extremely high degree of climate resilience. So when we talk about critical points of influence and using nutrition, the common response that I get when talking about critical points of influence, is I have all these climate factors. I have extreme hot, extreme cold, too wet, too dry. I have all these things that are producing stress on my crop that I can't control. Well, we can't control them. But what we can influence is we can influence the crop's response to that stress. We can change the stress response by making that crop a lot more resilient, by giving it the support, nutritional support, and the tools that it needs to be a lot more resilient. So, I've tried to describe the story as well as I can. And, of course, what I haven't told you, because there's way too much to tell you in an hour and 15 minutes, is how do you do this? And talk fast. There is just one very simple key, which is, and it's complex in its simplicity, and that is nutrient balance and mineral balance. Not nutrient density, not total mineral supply, but simply mineral balance. And this sounds very simplistic, and on the surface it is, but it's incredibly difficult to achieve. 5 years ago, in our consulting work, we started using plant sap analysis, which I'll be talking about more tomorrow. And when we started using sap analysis to evaluate the nutritional integrity of crops, it was an incredibly powerful and incredibly valuable tool. It's the single most valuable tool that I have ever used, and many consultants who use it say exactly the same thing, because it is so accurate, it is so sensitive, and it shows us so much. And what it showed us was that one of our fundamental paradigms about plant nutrition was completely wrong. We have operated from the paradigm that we need to address deficiencies. If you have a zinc deficiency, you put on zinc. If you have a phosphorus deficiency, you put on more phosphorus. If you have a potassium deficiency, you put on more potassium. And what we learned using SAP analysis is that the biggest problems with nutritional imbalances in agriculture are created by the excesses of products that the farmer applies, and that the excesses create the deficiencies. That is true for practically all of the macronutrients in 80% of the situations that we work on. So what we see happening over and over again is that we don't in fact have a potassium deficiency. We have an excess of calcium that is creating a potassium deficiency. We don't have a magnesium deficiency. We have an excess of calcium that is creating a magnesium deficiency. So, if there is one point that I would like for you to remember from this, it is simply that when someone tells you that one specific nutrient is very important for seed development and for fruit quality and for plant health, that is likely to be very true. But you can create a lot of problems by addressing that one nutrient in the absence of others. And we really have to address balance. So, to summarize, what we have observed is when you have plants that have 60% photosynthetic efficiency in every 24-hour photo period event instead of only 15 or 20%, then that the way that plant expresses itself changes. When we talk about environment determines genetic expression, I can tell you that when you take poor quality seed and you plant it into an optimum environment, the plant that will result is completely different from the plant that will result in a poor environment. But then, if you save the seed from that plant grown in optimal conditions with optimum nutrition, and you plant that seed, the child seed, there's a very high likelihood the child seed will not perform comparably to the parent. It is going to outperform the parent substantially in ways that you may not be able to predict. Leaf shape may completely change. Plant expression may completely change. This has nothing to do with hybridization, dehybridization. It has nothing to do with open pollinated plants. It has nothing to do with the original genetics. This happens across the board. But all of a sudden, that plant's expression can begin changing substantially, and usually, in our experience so far, it has always been in ways that favor the farmer. There is tremendous power in having high-quality seeds. So today, in the fruit and vegetable industry, I'm going to speak very frankly and pull no punches. Today in the fruit and vegetable industry, by and large, we have atrocious seed quality because, to the best of my knowledge, I am not aware of any commercial seed production companies or seed growers at the moment who are focusing on producing premium quality seed by managing nutrition. And this is one area in which I see a huge opportunity. There are many things that are happening in the biological agriculture, regenerative agriculture movement that are very positive and that are very powerful. And this is one opportunity that is still a gaping hole. It's a really big hole that we can still work on to fix. So, I think I will stop there and open it for questions, for any questions that you might have. Yes.
I wonder if you have a picture of one of those amazingly healthy plants none of us have ever seen.
Yes, I do have dozens. Unfortunately, we're not using my computer to present. I will try to, I still have a couple of presentations. I'll put them in some of my presentations for tomorrow. I have pictures of cucumbers, for example, that have 3 to 4 buds per node. I have pictures of eggplant where the leaves are 14 inches wide and 21 inches long. And many more. Yes.
Hi. Thank you. You mentioned like the blue corn. You said the plants are not dependent on water as much. But I was wondering, is it because the exudates help feed the mycorrhizae and you get the water for the soil? Because I think if you have increased, you have more pounds, you have to have more water. So it doesn't seem to make sense. You say it's not dependent on water as opposed to the mycorrhizae.
Very great question. I included one very key word in that phrase, and I'm happy to clarify. They are not dependent on free water. And so what I mean by that is that within soil, soil it appears dry and no longer has available water for the plant at 60% moisture. So there's still 60% water in the profile, but it is adsorbed and adhered to the soil colloid structure so tightly that the plant roots cannot absorb it. But in that environment, in an environment that visually to our eye and to our hand feels dry, mycorrhizal fungi can still access that water, which you mentioned, which is very, very correct. And the plants are absorbing microbial metabolites. So they're absorbing amino acids, they're absorbing organic acids, etc., which they can absorb without free water, both because of the fungal and bacterial colonization on the rhizosphere, and also because those nutrients are not water dependent. They're not water soluble to move. They don't have to be water soluble to move into the plant. Yes.
You mentioned briefly an oat cover crop before this planting of blue corn.
Yes.
Is that critical to your rotation from the oat to the blue corn, or can you expand on that planting of oats a little bit?
Yes, I can. Again, that could be.
Talking about
Right.
From the adsorbed water.
Right.
The oats, was that part of your inoculation?
So we started working with this farm they first started working with us in February, or I think it might have been March. I'm not sure exactly what the time frame was, but the oats had already been planted. We were not a part of that management decision-making process. Did the oats contribute to the yield response that we got? I believe absolutely yes, they did, and that if we had not had the oats cover crop, we would have had much less mycorrhizal colonization, and we would have had poorer soil structure, and we probably would not have had as good moisture-holding capacity. So the one interesting part, the one key piece was that on the 1st of May, I said that between the 1st of May and July 16th, or whatever the number was, we had 6/10 of an inch of rainfall. Just prior to that, there was about an inch of rain at the end of April. And on the cornfield that you saw across the street, the majority of that inch of rain ran off. On this field, it did not run off. It soaked into the soil. So I think in that context, that oats cover crop was very critical. But there is another piece as well that we have discovered since this happened 4 years ago. In the last 2 years, we have been doing a lot of research and trying to understand what it takes to produce a disease-suppressive soil. And this is an entire three-hour presentation in and of itself. It's way more than we can get into in this moment. But there is a very specific set of parameters, biochemistry parameters and soil biology parameters, that define a soil that actively antagonizes disease organisms, that completely eliminates Fusarium and Verticillium and Rhizoctonia and Pythium and Phytophthora. They do not have the chance to reproduce, which is incredibly powerful. And so we have been doing a lot of research and trying to understand how can we create that type of soil environment on the farms that we're working on. And we have discovered that oats as a cover crop are one of the key cover crop mechanisms that help produce a disease-suppressive soil environment. So I think there were possibly multiple things going on that cover crop also contributed to the success. Absolutely. Yes.
A lot of people focus on the seeds. I actually focus more on trees. And I would agree with you that the quality of trees that you can buy as saplings is unbelievably, you know.
Yes.
Huge. But going forwards, you know, what do you do for good tree stock? I mean, it's not easy.
Okay. So the comment was that looking at this from a trees from a perspective of growing trees, the quality of seedlings that are available is also extremely poor. And I completely agree, it is atrocious. And we do some consulting work on some of these nurseries, and I can tell you that they deliberately withhold nutrients and they deliberately withhold water to keep these seedlings small, because otherwise they have to spend a lot more time and effort and energy digging them out, pruning them, and shipping them. So I've always had a fairly heretical perspective on how extremely high-quality seedlings should be produced in an orchard system. And this last 2 years, 3 years now, actually started 4 years ago, we have been working with a cherry orchard that has given us the opportunity to really demonstrate what we're talking about. So what we are doing today on this cherry orchard is we are growing the trees in place. So we are buying the rootstock seedlings when they are just small whips, 9 to 10 inches tall, right out first year that they could get planted into the field. And so we're planting these small rootstocks, we're growing them for 1 year, and we're giving them an optimum environment. We are giving them optimum nutrition, foliar feeding them, irrigating them, they get compost applications, they get everything that a tree could possibly desire. It's absolutely an optimum environment, as optimum as anything can be out of doors. They grow extremely rapidly from being planted in late April or early May to August.
Our target is to have a stem caliper 3/4 inch in diameter. Then we graft on a sleeping eye bud at the base of that plant for whatever variety we want. And then the following spring, we clip off the rootstock and we put all the energy into one bud. We have already done this on one block that is, I think, 6 acres. We're doing a second block that was grafted this August and will now be growing from the bud next spring. And this is being done in high-density cherries, trees that are being planted 6 feet apart. And based on our first year experience, the second year we think is going to be even better because we've learned some different management techniques. We believe that in our second year, we are going to completely fill the tree row, and we're going to have a solid row of trees the second year, and we will have a full harvest the third year. Instead of trying to hold these trees back, we are pushing them. But we are not pushing them using nitrogen and synthetic forms of fertilizer. So they are growing extremely rapidly, and they are extremely high quality at the same time. So making that change, again, going back, most of us don't know what really healthy plants actually look like anymore. And this is completely changing the perspective of the entire cherry growing industry in the Pacific Northwest, because they have never in their wildest dream, and they usually expect to have their first harvest 6 years after planting, and we're talking about a full 100% harvest 3 years after planting. And right now, we have all the preliminary evidence to indicate that that is going to be a very strong probability. So it's pretty incredible. It's a lot of fun. Yep.
We have one. I just wanted to know how you feel about no-till and how important that is with respect to holding on to the mycorrhizal fungal networks. And have you done any work to try to figure out how to plant after a cover crop like oats or other cover crops without actually tillage, and done any side-by-sides or have any feelings on that?
So in the context of, and I'm going to specifically answer your question in the context of mycorrhizal fungi, just excluding the entire conversation about all the other benefits or potential challenges of no-till, just purely in the context of mycorrhizal fungi. Mycorrhizal fungi are completely dependent on a living root system. It has to be alive, it has to be actively growing. What we have observed and experienced is that mycorrhizal fungi can survive tillage and do survive tillage when you go from a growing crop to a growing crop. In other words, when you incorporate a cover crop and you plant seeds directly into it several days later and you have rapidly growing root systems, those root systems will be colonized by mycorrhizae and they will keep on going. It's when you have an extended period of a dead fallow period where there are no actively growing root systems that the mycorrhizal population is going to crash very substantially. How long is that window? Because I know that's the next question you're going to ask. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. It seems we haven't done enough research on it. We have definitely observed this to be the case. And it varies from with different soil types. Sandier soils have a shorter window. But I would say the window is usually in the neighborhood of about 10 to 14 days. So it's not immediate 2-3 days later. You do have a short window that mycorrhizal fungi will still survive. And if you would have asked me that question 2 years ago, I would have given you the exact opposite answer. But in the last 2 years, we have seen that to be true on enough farms that I know it is accurate. Yes?
The soil mycorrhiza and everything you've been talking about, I'm assuming that is not possible if they're using glyphosate or salt fertilizers?
Well, definitely many of the materials that are used in commercial agriculture, glyphosate, herbicides, fungicides, seed treatments, fertilizers, etc., tend to have a very suppressing effect on soil biology, and they can definitely prevent mycorrhizal colonization, and they don't fit into a biological system. Yeah.
This is specific, but you mentioned that if increased nutrients increases regulation of stomata, and I'm just wondering what exactly... what the stomata doing differently than one that has a plant that's not very well nutrients?
Yeah, so in particular, the key nutrient for stomata regulation is potassium. Potassium is very strongly connected to osmoregulation. And so basically it facilitates a faster plant response. So faster opening and closing of the stomata. So what that means is that during the 24-hour photocycle, circadian rhythms, etc., it manages the signaling between photorespiration, photosynthesis pathways much faster. And the short answer is that the stomata is open for a much shorter period of time, so you lose a lot less water. The photosynthesis capacity will go. So the question was, does the photosynthesis capacity then also go down? And the short answer is yes. The photosynthesis capacity does go down, as it will whenever you have. So you kind of have this balance between photosynthesis and photorespiration. When you have a plant stress response in a high temperature environment, you're going to have the potential for greater levels of photorespiration, which is, this is not technically correct, but in terms of plant growth patterns, you could almost say that it is the opposite of photosynthesis. So in these very high temperature conditions, when you have 100 plus degree days, most of the plant's sugar accumulation happens earlier in the morning and later in the day. And the stomata are closed throughout the day. Also, something very important in the context of corn in particular, that corn, being a C4 photosynthetic pathway, continues to photosynthesize in much higher temperatures. C3 pathway plants, such as tomatoes and cantaloupe, for example, cap at 86 degrees Fahrenheit. They don't continue to photosynthesize past that point. In terms of carbon sequestration and photosynthesis, there are three ecosystems which exceed all other ecosystems' capacity to sequester carbon by a substantial margin. The first is a young growth coniferous forest, an evergreen forest that is growing very rapidly, will sequester carbon faster than any other ecosystem. The second is perennial polyculture that is being intensively grazed with intensively managed rotational grazing. And the third, anyone care to guess? Is corn. The third is corn. It is actually possible to build soil organic matter while we are growing corn. We've done it. We've proven it. Not on one farm, not on five farms, not on 100 farms, but on many more than that, on tens of thousands of acres. And the simple premise that corn is a crop which extracts carbon from the soil and contributes to soil degradation is true because of the way that we have screwed it up. It isn't inherently and automatically true. Yes?
Just to add to that, so that's not corn every year, right? So give us a little background.
Yes, that is corn every year.
Really?
That is corn every year. We have seen it corn on corn. We now have, we only have 5 years of data at this point. We only started it 5 years ago. But we have 5 years of data where in 5 years on dryland corn in Kansas, so this is, we're talking 10, 11 inches of annual rainfall, we have seen soil organic matter increase from a baseline level of 1.5% all the way up to 5.5% in 5 years. You can imagine what that does for water absorption capacity.
I hope their neighbors are paying attention to all this.
Oh, it's really risky in the corn crop. You can't spend any money. I'm being facetious. All right. Do we have time for one more question? No more questions. Everybody's got it all figured out. Oh, there's one over here.
John, your concluding statement that mineral balance is really the key to all this. What are the implications for us as farmers in terms of supplementation then? You know, a lot of times there's recommendations and we can't apply what we need to apply because of cost or whatever, so we choose to go a more cost-effective route and apply, you know, the most efficient nutrient, for instance. But to your statement, that would be throwing us out of balance. So just in general, how do we move forward with mineral balancing where mineral balancing is so critical and so easily disrupted?
So, very, very good question. The easy answer is that you hire Advancing Eco-Agriculture to help you figure it out. So, When I think about the consulting work that we do as a company and how we address these challenges on a farm, there's a couple of different pieces. Okay, as a starting point, we operate from the premise of that the plant is the report card, not the soil test, which is fundamentally at odds with the way organic and biological agriculture have approached plant nutrition. So historically, nutrient recommendations were made based on a soil analysis. And I'm not saying, and I don't want to be perceived as saying that soil analysis doesn't have any value, because it does. But soil analysis is still a very much an imperfect science. And the big frustration for us, when I founded Advancing Eco-Agriculture 10 years ago, and the experiences that we had on our own farm, we are obsessed with one thing, and that is results. We have to get results. And far too many times, over and over and over again, we would use soil analysis and make recommendations based on the soil analysis, and we would fail to get results. And I know that for many of you as farmers, you probably have experienced that. You don't see the crop response that you would like to see. So we changed that, and we started looking and considering the plant to be our report card. We still use the soil analysis to try to to help us understand what is happening and what is going on. But we use the plant as an indicator of what we should apply and what we should not apply. And then, so that's the first part. And I'm going to be talking about this in more detail tomorrow when I talk about plant sap analysis and how we do this. But then the second part, the second piece, is that usually the first thing that we are trained to address is to address the deficiencies. And we have said that that cannot be the first rule, it has to be the second rule. The first priority is to address the antidote to the excesses. So let's say you have a soil that says that you have high levels of magnesium and low levels of calcium and high levels of potassium. I'm just making up a scenario. The historical approach would have been to say, okay, magnesium and potassium are adequate and calcium is low, therefore we need to add calcium. When in fact, we get the biggest crop response when we don't. I'm not saying we shouldn't add calcium, but I'm saying that's the number two priority. The number one priority is to put on the antidote for the high potassium and the high magnesium. And that might be calcium in some soil types. In some soil types, it might be sulfur. And in all soil types, regardless of soil type, whenever you have high potassium, it will be manganese, because manganese will downregulate the absorption of potassium. So that's just a hypothetical scenario, but just to as a framework, the number one priority needs to be to suppress the excesses, and only the number two priority to address the deficiencies for all of the macronutrients, for all the major elements, calcium, magnesium, potassium, sulfur, phosphorus, and so forth. Now, I can put this thing down. That is for all the major elements. For the trace minerals, that does not hold true. For boron, zinc, manganese, copper, iron, etc., when you do have a deficiency there, then you need to address it and get the apply those deficiencies. Now, what has set us apart as a company, as a consulting company at Advancing Eco-Agriculture, is that we do not consider soil amendments as a primary way to produce a crop response. It's very secondary. Our biggest emphasis and what we work with the most is with foliar applications of nutrients. And in the organic and biological community, sometimes people have the response or the approach as, well, that's unsustainable. We don't want to continue applying nutrients every year, year after year, that we need to rebuild our soil. And in fact, our experience has been the exact opposite. Foliar applications of nutrients are the most economical way to produce a substantial crop response so that we can be more profitable, And foliar applications of nutrients are also the fastest and most economical way to build soil health. The exact contrary of what we've been taught. Because when you use foliar applications of nutrients and you help plants increase their photosynthesis level, you are not only increasing yield and increasing quality, but you are also transmitting a lot of root exudates out to the soil profile. And when you do the math, when you do the arithmetic, and you calculate the amount of plant biomass per acre, and if 25% of that, if you have the plant biomass per acre above the soil surface, and 25% of that represents root exudates, and 25% represents root biomass, 50% being below the soil surface, you very quickly realize that you can't afford to put on enough compost to match that. So, for the trace minerals, I'm giving you a very long circuitous answer here. For the trace minerals, particularly all the metals, this would exclude boron. So for iron, manganese, zinc, copper, and cobalt, from our perspective, those nutrients almost must be addressed in foliars, or at the very least in the form of liquids, and not dry soil amendments. And this is, again, another conversation that ties into the concept of developing disease-suppressive soils. But all of these metals, manganese and iron and so forth, exist in the soil in different oxidation states. So if you think about iron, for example, you can have an iron nail that is new and shiny. You expose it to air and sunshine and water, it's going to start rusting. That rust is oxidized iron. Plants cannot absorb oxidized iron. They can only absorb iron in what is called the reduced form. And so the challenge is that when you apply 20 pounds per acre of manganese sulfate, or 20 pounds per acre of, or 5 pounds per acre of copper sulfate, or 6 pounds per acre of zinc sulfate, any of these trace mineral sulfates, when you apply them to the soil, then there is a, actually, I need to adjust what I said for just a moment. This is true for all the metals with the exception of zinc. This does work for zinc because zinc only has one oxidation state. For manganese and for iron and so forth, whatever you apply to the soil will not be absorbed by those plants in your lifetime because it has to be converted to the reduced form, which takes very highly functioning soil biology. We had a farmer who very badly wanted this to not be true. Very badly. And he experimented with putting manganese sulfate, combining manganese sulfate with very high quality compost. And this was very good compost. I've seen it work at some of the best quality compost that I've ever seen. He pre-mixed the manganese sulfate with the compost with the intention that that biological activity should help the manganese sulfate release. And he did test plots, 20 pounds, 40 pounds, 80 pounds, 160, 200, 400 pounds per acre manganese sulfate. On the SAP analysis, in terms of plant response and plant absorption, the manganese numbers did not change for 3 years. And that's still up to this day, they haven't changed. We don't know what they will be next year, but there has been zero crop response from those applications of manganese sulfate. So for the trace minerals, the most economical way to address trace minerals is to put on what this year's crop requires this year in a liquid form as foliar sprays or in the irrigation system and get a maximum crop response. And then the reality is that all the soil here in New England has 200 plus pounds per acre of manganese already in the top 6 inches of the soil profile. That manganese can become available when you have an extremely aggressive microbial community. And that happens when you get these really large root systems with a lot of root exudates. So what we have seen happening is that we're putting on, in many cases, over the course of a season, we might be putting on ounces per acre of manganese to get a maximum crop response. But then over a 2-year, 3-year period of doing that, all of a sudden it becomes unnecessary because the manganese on the soil analysis comes up all by itself, way more than what we have applied. It's not a linear mathematical equation at all. So, very long answer. All right. I'm getting the dead air signal. So, thank you all for being here. We'll see you more tomorrow.